Okay, Boker Tov, everybody. Erev Tov, if you're in Israel, and I hope everybody is doing well and had a nice Yontif, and we should hear good news from Israel and around the world. I think it's a difficult situation now, and I know people, you know, there'll be an increase of anti-Semitism here in North America and all kinds of not good things, but please God, we Jews are optimists. Otherwise, we wouldn't be around for all these years. And I guess talking about the third Beit HaMikdash, which is the topic of today's shiur, is you have to be full of optimism, because if we've been waiting for 2,000 years and we still don't have it and we can still talk about it, that's a pretty amazing thing. So with that little introduction, Rabbi, Bakashat's all yours.
Okay. Shalom to everybody. The issue of animal sacrifices in the third temple is a very interesting topic, because on the one hand, Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer, when he began Mivasrei Tzion, he was the first one to write in his Sefer Drishat Tzion about the idea of bringing the redemption, of going back to the land of Israel and buying it. And the third chapter of his Sefer Drishat Zion is how to restart animal sacrifices. On the other hand, already about 70 years ago, when they first printed Rav Kook's commentary on the Sidur, Olat Re'iyah, there is a small hint there that Rav Kook feels that there may not be animal sacrifices in the third Beit HaMikdash. And obviously, Rav Kook knows all of the questions that people will raise. What about, we can't change mitzvot, we can't take away mitzvot. What? Sefer Vayikra, one-fifth of the Torah, isn't going to be applicable? Rav Kook knows all those questions. And I think what we're going to see today is a very important example of how the Sanhedrin, which hopefully will be revived, hopefully in our generation, how they can and will update halacha. And this has a lot of ramifications. A lot of people ask, you know, about certain questions regarding women's rights and halacha and aguna, or even the bracha shelo asani isha, or things that seem that they need to be updated, kitniot on Pesach. And the question is, is there a possibility that there will not be animal sacrifices in the third Beit HaMikdash? Now, I want to stress that this class, this topic, is relatively complicated. Because a lot of things that people have been saying in the name of Rav Kook are wrong. Because as soon as Rav Kook hinted that there may not be animal sacrifices, again, that was about 70 years ago, a lot of people started taking educated guesses. What is he basing himself upon? And those guesses turned out to be totally wrong, because a couple years ago, I have the privilege of being in charge of Rav Kook's archives in Beit Rav Kook. And a couple years ago, we found and published the notebooks where Rav Kook writes 7 or 8 different reasons how to justify how maybe there will not be animal sacrifices in the third Beit HaMikdash. Now, this sounds conservative, or with a large C, or maybe even reform. Don't worry, Rav Kook is 100% Orthodox. And what we're going to see today is part of his innovative thinking. But let's start with Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer. Let's look together on the share screen, where I brought for you at the beginning of the source sheet a couple of quotes from Drishat Zion. That was Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer, his first and classic work on modern Zionism. And he writes as follows: Mina shlosha dvarim asher alemo ha'olam homed hu avoda lakriv korbanot u'la'alot reach nichoach lifanav. Maybe I'll just mention what are the first two. The first two chapters of Drishat Zion, Rav Kalischer writes about the importance of bringing the Geula through natural processes. That the picture that we got in kindergarten of the Mashiach flying out of the sky and Beit HaMikdash crashing down. And Rav Tzvi Kalischer brings a lot of sources showing that in all probability, it's going to be a natural process. And that's the first chapter. The second chapter is on the importance of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, of settling and building and buying the land of Israel and setting up agriculture in the land of Israel, which today sounds pretty logical, right? We've all learned together religious Zionism. But if you think that in the middle of the 19th century, somebody is the first one to write about it, he must have been a little ahead of his time. So Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer says again that there are three things on which the world stands. We all know in Pirkei Avot, the ethics of our fathers, Ala Torah v'al Avodah v'al Gmilut Chasadim. The world stands on the Torah, the Avodah, service of God, which usually in rabbinic literature is referring to the korbanot, the sacrifices, v'al Gmilut Chasadim, kindness. Im yurshelan mitam ha-malchuyot, Asot barakodesh kechefetz libenu. Rav Kalischer continues, and he says that if the governments, you have to remember, in his time it's the Turks, if the Turks will allow us to do what we need or want to do on the Temple Mount, im yeh reshut beit, I'll add parenthetically that today, even when we have a Jewish state, and we've had the city of Yerushalayim already for 50 years, we see that the issue is complicated. But nevertheless, Rav Kalischer writes, "Im yereshut be'et hazot la'lot reach nichoach lefanav olo, would it be proper to give animal sacrifices to make that pleasant fragrance, as it says in Parshat Pinchas? Kvar nifseka alacha b'Talmud k'Rabbi Yoshua. The Talmud says that the decision, halachic decision, is like Rabbi Yoshua's opinion." Who says Shamati Shemakrivim Af Alpi She'en Bait? And the Rambam brings us down the halacha that you don't need a Beit HaMikdash to give sacrifices. In other words, if the government will let us, there is nothing preventing us. Shekedusha Rishona Kidshalu Shata Ula Atid Lavo. The halacha is like the Rambam and not like the Ravid, that the first Kiddusha is in Yerushalayim, is also was in its time, but also continued afterwards over the whole land of Israel. That's more complicated. And what we have today is the holiness of the second temple. But in Yerushalayim, the first temple's holiness continues until this day. And that's the halachic problem of somebody who is not pure to go up to the Temple Mount. We know that the Temple Mount today is a lot larger than it used to be. There are certain places that a person, even if he's impure, can go. There's a certain places, if a person goes to a mikveh, he can go. There are certain places that everybody agrees you're not allowed to go. Ukamosha bi'arti le'el minasifre, shilon namtin al navi. Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer says, we do not have to and we should not wait for prophets. Because if we can bring animal sacrifices, most important is the Korban Pesach, Rak Nidrosh Tzion V'achar Kach Yavo Navi. What we have to do is we have to take the practical steps also to want Yerushalayim and also to take the practical political steps to buy the land, to convince who's ever in charge. U'kemo b'manoach sh'mafli la'asot al yedei Hikarvo HaKorban, that just like Shimshon's father, Samson's father, Manoach, he did a great thing when he brought a sacrifice. It wasn't even in the Mishkan. It wasn't even in the Holy Temple. Nevertheless, it was considered something great. V'im nishmor az al tarat ha-kohanim al yidei navi lo yeh korban. If we're waiting for a prophet to show us who is a Kohen and who's not a Kohen, then there probably will never be animal sacrifices again. Because Rav Kalischer says that is like the chicken and the egg. If you're waiting for Elijah the prophet to tell us where the exact place of the Beit HaMikdash of the Mizbeach of the altar is supposed to be, we might be waiting a long time. And theoretically, there are others that say that Eliyahu will come only after we revive the korbanot. So, mimanafshach, either way, maybe there's not going to be that can't be, that there's not going to be service in the Beit HaMikdash. Rav Kalischer goes on and he discusses the major questions, the major issues of that have to be solved halachically in order to restart animal sacrifices. He deals with the issue of the place of the Mikdash. And he basically answers, I'm obviously answering in short, he says, well, there are sridim, there are remnants on Har HaBayit, and there are poskim, there's a famous Ritbaz, and we have traditions. And not only that, what do you do in halacha if there's a doubt? The poskim decide. And not only that, even theoretically, the poskim can decide, say you're in doubt, say that there's two possible places where the altar might have to be, here or here. The halachic solution would be to build a large altar, which would cover all the different shittot, all the different opinions. The second issue that he deals with is that we're tmei met, that we don't have the efer of parah adumah, we don't have the ashes of the red heifer, and as long as we don't have it, all of us, anybody who's ever been in a hospital, in a Jewish hospital, probably, or in a cemetery for sure, and even Kohanim have been in hospitals. So most people today are born in hospitals, and in Israel, Jewish hospitals, at almost any given moment, there is tumat mate. There is a dead person in the hospital. On the other hand, Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer says, there's a very simple klal. Most of you probably are familiar, tuma hutra b'tzibur, that if everybody is impure, so nobody is impure. And the third and final issue that we mention is the idea of Kohanim. Who are Kohanim? Right? We know that there's Chizkat Kohanim, that most people today who are Kohanim, it's because their father was a Kohen and he heard from his father there was a Kohen. On the other hand, I heard from historians that there are not a few people when they came to America started calling themselves Kohanim just in order to get money for Pidyon HaBen. And not every person with the name Kohen is halachically a Kohen. I know in my family, there's a branch called the Levines. And I think in my generation, there's not even one Jewish Levine. So not only are they not Levim, they're not even Jewish. And if so, there are plenty of people who father may have been a Kohen, or they have the name Kohen. On the other hand, Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer says that's also a very easy solution. Why? Because there are some families who do have their yichus. The Yemenite Kohanim, many, many of the families have the name of their father's 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 father until Aaron HaKohen. There was an island called Jerba, right outside of Morocco. And most of the people there were Kohanim, and they had their yichus. They had the name of their father's 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 father. I have a neighbor who many of you have heard of, Roni Alshich. He was the minister of police, the chief of police for 2 years until recently. And he is a Levi who has his yichus. He has the name of his father's 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 father. In Ashkenazic families, it is less common. And supposedly, there is one Ashkenazic family that has their yichus. back to Aaron HaKohen. That is the Rappaport family. If people know Rappaports who are Kohanim, they are supposedly the only Ashkenazic family that has their ichus. Somebody mentions that there are now genetic markers for male Kohanim. And in the meantime, they haven't been accepted by the poskim. But I wouldn't be surprised if the Sanhedrin decides to accept that. That could be another possibility. I once asked my brother, who's a historian, I asked him, how's it possible? That sounds weird. That all of a sudden, in all of Ashkenaz, there's one family who kept their yichus. That they know their father's mother. What's special about this family? And my brother answered, look at their name. The name is Rappaport. Well, my brother explained to me the name Rappaport means that they were originally from Portugal and they're not really Ashkenazim. And that is why they are such an exception to the rule. Anyway, to summarize Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer's opinion, and by the way, he wrote with Rabbi Akiva Eger, with the Chatam Sofer, with Rav Eliel Guttmacher, and there are a lot of first-rate poskim who agreed with him that we do not need to wait for the Mashiach, we do not need to wait for the Beit HaMikdash in order to revive animal sacrifices. That is Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer. Rav Kook, on the other hand, as I said before, is a super innovative thinker. And he writes, and this is the hint that appeared about 70 years ago, which spread like a hot fire, that maybe there won't, according to Orthodox Jewry, according Rav Kook, remember, was one of the greatest Gedolim, according, everybody knows that he's one of the greatest Gedolim. Anybody who has any doubts, there's a interesting book called Igrot Lauriya, Letters to Rav Kook, where you see how the Chazon Ish asks Rav Kook halacha questions. You see how the greatest Gedolim of the past century all held Rav Kook in unbelievable esteem. Just an example, Rav Yitzchak Kuttner, the Rosh Yeshiva of Chaim Berlin, who had learned, he was the younger Chevruta with Rav Kook. He knew Rav Kook very, very well. And he mentioned to Rav Eliezer Waldman, the Rosh Yeshiva of Kiryat Arba, I'm giving all the details so that you know that it's documented, that he knew that Rav Waldman was a religious Zionist, the Rosh Yeshiva and a Hezder Yeshiva. And he said to him that you should know Rav Kook was 20 times greater than all of the anti-Zionist Gedolim who opposed him, put together. When Rav Huttner says something like that, that's pretty strong. Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, we have documented that his son was once asked Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, who is your Rebbe? And Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach said, the Rav who did my chuppah. So his son asked him, who did your chuppah? And Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach answered, he was your Sandik. So the son was really curious. He said, so tell me, who is your Rebbe? Who is my Sandik? And Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach said, Vi Gadol Hador. That was Rav Kook. And Rav Moshe Feinstein, and Rav Yosef Elio Henkin, and anybody who's anybody in the Torah world knew that Rav Kook was an unbelievable Gadol. And I just mentioned that to stress, we're not talking here reform or conservative or... And when you look at his sources, you'll see that it's not even a machloket, that it's really not that complicated an issue. But he says that there may not be animal sacrifices in the third Beit HaMikdash. Let us see together the source which shook the world. Source number one, right after Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer. Kalischer, I should say, rather, with a European rather than a Midwestern accent. Here, source number one. Rav Kook writes in Olat Re'iya, which was a compilation which his son, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook, took from many of his writings. And he writes as follows. Anybody who davens knows at the very end of Shmona Esrei, we say, Varva l'Hashem minchat Yehuda v'Yerushalayim Kimei olamuch shanim kadmoniot. This pasuk from Malachi, from the Navi Malachi, literally means, and it will be pleasant to God, the vegetarian sacrifice in Yehuda and Jerusalem, as it was in the old days and the days of yore. And Rav Kook points out, why does Malachi say it is going to be vegetarian sacrifices and not animal sacrifices? The word for animal sacrifices is zvachim. Zevach is literally to slaughter. Mincha is a vegetarian sacrifice. Continues Rav Kook. Excuse me, we're in source number one. La'atid lavo, in the future. Shefa hadat yitpashet v'yachdor afilu b'ba'alei chayim. The wisdom will even get into animals, will be wiser than they are today. Lo yareo v'lo yashchitu b'chol arkudshi ki mala haretz de'et Hashem. The Navi Yeshayahu tells us that the whole mountain of God will be filled with knowledge, and they will not shepherd, they will not graze, there will be no grazing and no slaughtering in the Temple Mount. And the sacrifices will be mincha, me'atzomeach, vegetarian sacrifices. Te'arev la'ashem kimei olam uchshanim kadmoniot. And when we talk about restarting the third temple, Rav Kook is telling us pretty clearly that there may not be animal sacrifices. By the way, just in case even one person leaves us early, I want to stress that Rav Kook is not saying definitely. There are other places where he says there may be, there may not be. What we're going to learn now is how to halachically justify that should the Sanhedrin want, should the poskim want, Rav Kook prepares a plan in the drawer, what's called in Hebrew a tochnit megera. How do you say that in English? I don't know. A plan in the drawer, which is waiting for should the poskim.
Contingency plan.
Sorry?
Contingency plan.
Okay, contingency plan. Thank you. I just learned a new term in English. Should the poskim decide, by the way, you don't even need a Sanhedrin to make such decisions. Should the poskim decide that sacrifices turn off more people to Judaism than it turns on, Rav Kook is preparing a game plan with 7 or 8 proofs that they can use. Now, it's important to stress that what a lot of, you know what, let's see together source number two. This is another source which was just published recently from Me'orot HaRe'iyah. In Rav Kook's drasha for Shabbat HaGadol, he writes, Lo yetzarich lakachat mehem ulakriv, v'ye isur bazeh, v'tiyeh hakrava rak mincha me'atzomeach. Here Rav Kook goes even a step further and says that maybe there will be even a prohibition, an isur, to bring animal sacrifices in the third temple. Where does he get that from? Now, it's important to stress that where most of you think he got it from, that is not where he got it from. When people looked for what could be Rav Kook's source for not having animal sacrifices in the third Beit HaMikdash, a lot of people, including Professor Yeshaya Leibovich, the brother of Nechama Leibovich, it's interesting, when they were alive, I think more people heard of Yeshaya Leibovich. He was a very, very controversial person. In his writings, for example, in many places, he says he doesn't believe in Mashiach, he doesn't believe in Tchiyat HaMetim. Some said that he said he doesn't really believe in God in the conventional sense of the word. And Yeshayahu Leibovich claimed that The source of Rav Kook is from the Rambam in Moreh Nevuchim, in the Guide for the Perplexed. Let's see it inside, but I'll already tell you from the beginning, don't make mistakes about it. This is not the source of Rav Kook. But this is what people thought, and it's interesting what they thought. Source number three, the Rambam writes in the Guide for the Perplexed, Chelek Gimel, Perek Lamed Bet, ולפיכך, לא ייתכן כפי טבע האדם שיעזוב כל מה שהורגל לו בבת אחת. The Rambam is writing why the Torah allowed or obligated sacrifices. There are a heck of a lot of mitzvot. 1/6 of the Shas is kodashim, is animal sacrifices. The Rambam says that the ta'am of the mitzvah that he gives, the benefit of the mitzvah, is because in the olden days, all the Jews in Egypt were used to animal sacrifices. That's how religions worked. Right? People of all the religions, all the paganists, they would go to their temples and they would give animal sacrifices. God, in his infinite wisdom, the Rambam is saying that God could not have and knew that it would be unwise to tell the Jews when we left Egypt not to give animal sacrifices. He had to let us and command us to give animal sacrifices because that's how religions work. We all have habits, and the habit of people in those days, that's how they serve their gods. Vayana says, Zeaz, Kamo iluban avibiz manim alalu, Vikorela avodat Hashem viomer. Can you imagine a person, says the Rambam, coming in the modern world and saying, Hine tziva Hashem etchem shalotit palolulo? God says, don't pray to him anymore. Vilotatsumu, and no more fasts. All right, the Christians wouldn't accept it. The Muslims wouldn't accept it. And you know what? The Jews also wouldn't accept it. Ulefichach iniach yitale otam mine avodot ve'avirami otam lenivraim lishmo yitale. So what God did is when we were primitive, when the Jewish people 3,333 years ago, he took us out of Egypt. Hashem said, you know what? From now on, you continue giving sacrifices, but to God, the one and only monotheistic God, no more paganism. Lefichach tzivanu livnot echal lo, ve'asu li mikdash, ve'shiyeh ha-korban lo. And that is why God gave the commandment that there should be a Beit HaMikdash, that we should bring sacrifices. Continues the Rambam. V'yodea ani ki nafshecha hatirata min ha'inyan hazeh. He says, I know that you, the reader, who is an intellectual philosopher, you will not like what I am saying. Everybody knows the Rambam was not scared of being innovative, was not scared of being controversial. We also know that some of the Balei Tosfot, like Rabbeinu Yonah, did not like the Rambam's Moreh Nevuchim. At first thought, people are not going to like what I am saying. And you're going to ask me, there are so many details that he in the animal sacrifices. Here you give a male, here you give a female, here it's an ox, here it's 13 oxes, here it is a sheep, here it's a male sheep, here it's a goat, here's... There are so many details. How can you claim that God is not interested in all of these details? Why did he give us so many details? The Rambam Maimonides says these details are not the goal of the sacrifices. I'll mention parenthetically that the Kabbalists have a lot of symbolism to say on why here it is a bull and here it is a cow. And why here it's male and there it's female. And there is a lot of symbolism found in the commentaries and the Kabbalistic commentaries in the Hasidic masters. The Rambam, as expected, does not go in that direction. Ela machmat davar acher. All the details of the animal sacrifices that we find in the book of Leviticus in Vayikra, it's for another reason. We say at the beginning of Parshat Beshalach that God took the Jews out of Egypt, but he did not take the short way to Eretz Yisrael through Gaza, Ashdod, Ashkelon, but rather preferred to take us all the way around through Ammon, Moab, the Sinai Desert. Why? It really would have been better, and if we were in a better position, God would have brought us the short way out of Egypt, straight to the land of Israel. But machmat kshash ma she'en yecholet legufoteyam alav lisavlo kefi hateva. The Rambam is saying that our Father in heaven is very merciful. He knows where we are at. He doesn't demand too much. He doesn't demand too little. But he knew that if he would take us the short way and we would have to fight the Philistines, a lot of people would just turn around and run back to Egypt or run away. And Bikitzur, just like parents know their children very well, I remember my parents telling me that, and now I'm old enough and my children are old enough that I can use that line on them as well. We all know the parents really know their children very, very well. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, how much more so, a million times, he knows us very well. And that's why, says the Rambam, if God would not have given us all of these details regarding sacrifices, we wouldn't have taken them seriously. And we wouldn't have thought of them as godly. Says Professor Yeshayahu Leibovich, this infers that animal sacrifices are bidieved, are not the best idea. And that God only in when Am Yisrael was primitive, he begrudgingly allowed us to give sacrifices. But today in the modern world, says Professor Leibovich, if there will be a third temple, in his opinion, do you believe there will be a third temple? There, according to the Rambam, there will not be animal sacrifices. Now, the problem with that is, first of all, it's not just that Rav Kook does not buy that. The reason is because the Rambam himself does not buy that. The Rambam himself says, let's see, in source number 6, the Rambam writes in several places. We're running out of time, so anybody who can learn the sources, all of them, so you can learn them afterwards. Let's look at the Rambam in Hilchot Melachim, Perek Yud Aleph, Halacha Aleph. The Rambam talks about Melech HaMashiach Hatid La'amod U'lachzir Malchut David Liyoshna. The Mashiach will return the house of David to be the king. U'bone HaMikdash, he will build the Beit HaMikdash. V'chozrin Kol HaMishpatim B'yamav, and all of the mitzvot will return in the days of the Mashiach, Kishayu Mikodem, just like they were in the old days. Makrivin korbanot, etc., etc. Yes, we will give those same animal sacrifices that we did in the first and the second temple. And not only that, the obvious question is, what about Cain and Hevel? Cain and Abel, they gave sacrifices, and we know that Abel, Hevel, gave animal sacrifices, and they were not influenced by pagan religions. Question number 2. Question number 3. The Rambam in Moreh Nevuchim, in the same book, Guide for the Perplexed, when he talks about Ta'amei HaMitzvot, by the way, I'll just say parenthetically, many of you know Hebrew, and you know that Ta'amei HaMitzvot literally means, it doesn't mean the reason for the mitzvot, because we don't know the reason why God gave us the mitzvot. We can take educated guesses about the benefit of the mitzvot, but what does the word ta'amei ha-mitzvot mean? What is ta'im? If something is ta'im. Taste. Exactly. And we all know that a lot of children don't like their vegetables, but if they're tasty, they will eat their vegetables. And similarly, if we can find the mitzvot tasty and see the benefit, then we will have that much more motivation to do the mitzvot. That's the concept of tamei mitzvot, to make the mitzvot tasty. It's not the reason behind the mitzvot. The Sefer HaChinuch calls it shoresh ha-mitzvah, calls it the root of the mitzvah. But when the Rambam talks about chelek gimel, by the way, I'll just mention parenthetically, this group I can see from your eyes is a high-level group. Some of you may be interested in learning Moreh Nevuchim, a word for the wise. Don't start with the first or second parts. Go straight to Ma'amar Shlishi, to the third article. Why? Because that's what almost every time you've heard the Rambam quoted, it's from Chelek Shlishi, Ma'amar Shlishi. Why? Because that's where the Rambam talks about Ta'amei HaMitzvot. And usually, especially in the modern world, especially regarding Balei Tshuva, somebody becomes religious at the age of 20, 30, 40. He's not from birth. He wants to understand what are the mitzvot about. I'll also mention that the Rambam calls the mitzvot Etzot Mirachok, based on a pasuk. And in the Zohar, the mitzvot are called Atzata, Etzot, good ideas. It's a good idea to put on tefillin. And Rav Kook writes in Ma'amar Hador that today, as we approach redemption, that Am Yisrael is returning to the land of Israel, and we have revived the desert, we have revived the holy language, we have revived the state of Israel. God also wants to revive a higher level of Torah, whereas if in previous generations, people were religious just because of peer pressure, or that's what your father made you do, or that's what Jews do. Today, I know in the Pew survey, they found that 93% of the Jews in North America are not religious, are not Orthodox. And if so, I guess Jews don't do that anymore. Today, most Jews thrive on Shabbat. Most Jews do not follow the Torah and Mitzvot. Rav Kook explains that that is part of the beauty of democracy. That today, anybody who is religious because he wants to be, is because he identifies with the beauty of the mitzvot. And so the Rambam, when he talks about ta'amei mitzvot, the benefits of the mitzvot, the most common answer that he gives is la'afuke mi'ovdei avodah zarah. Because in the olden days, the paganists used to do a lot of things. They used to drink blood, so we don't drink blood. Let's look together in source number 4. I just brought you an example. There are a lot of examples where the Rambam says the Torah tells us that you have to do this or you can't do that, because that's what the paganists do. And let's look together in source number 4, where the Rambam, in the same Guide for the Perplexed, writes, Matarat kol haTorah v'tzira asher alav hi sovevet, the hinge on which the Torah revolves, the main hinge, husiluk avodah zarah u'michiyat tikvoteah, to get totally rid of any remembrance of avodah zarah, of idolatry. The Rambam is pretty convinced. He says there is no doubt. Ki isur ashatnez, the prohibition of wearing linen and wool together, is because the Ovdei Avodah Zarah, the paganists, they, in their temples, they used to wear wool and linen together. So we davka don't. Ve'akilayim, the idea of an orla, the idea of eating fruits before the fourth year, in Avodah Zarah they do it, so we davka don't. And kilayim, the idea of planting two different species together, all of this is machmat Avodah Zarah. It's because this is what the paganists used to do, and therefore we don't do it, and the Torah tells us to do differently. Now, according to Professor Leibovich, does that mean that today we can wear shatnez, we can eat orla, we can wear kilayim, we can do all of their tens and tens, I never counted, but a lot of mitzvot that the Rambam says, it's to show that we were different from the paganists. According to Professor Leibovich, where there's no Yetzer, there's no desire for paganism anymore. So according to that, all these mitzvot are going to change. Obviously not. That is not where Rav Kook gets it from. Because again, according to Professor Leibovich, if the whole idea of animal sacrifices was b'di'evet, that God begrudgingly allowed them, but he doesn't really want them. Again, that sounds like where Rav Kook is going. No, Rav Kook doesn't even mention that because of the reasons that I mentioned. And especially because the Rambam himself says, yes, there will be animal sacrifices in the third temple. If so, where does Rav Kook get it from? And how can you justify changing so many changes in Halacha, in Sefer Vayikra? Let's look together in Source 10, because this is what was published just several years ago. And when we published it, it shook the Torah world, because Rav Kook is extremely innovative here. And he has a lot of guts. And by the way, again, most rabbanim, most rabbis, poskim, don't have as much guts as Rav Kook does. And that is why he prepared this plan. Batya, what do you call this plan again? The plan in the drawer?
Contingency plan.
Okay. Contingency plan. Let us see it inside. After this long introduction, we are finally getting to the main point. Source number 10. Paragraph Bet. By the way, I have to mention, even though we don't have that much time, all of this Rav Kook is adding on as a second floor on the Chazon HaTzimchonut, which he wrote. Rav Kook writes, and again, we're just going to do this very briefly and orally, but you have the sources if you want to learn it inside in source number 9. Rav Kook writes that God originally in the Garden of Eden planned for man to be a vegetarian and only begrudgingly allowed us to eat meat after the Mabul. The Kohen Gadol does wear shabbos, yes. You're saying that would be another question on Professor Leibovich. Yes, we're on the Rambam. Rav Kook writes that the original plan was for man to be vegetarian. And that's why in the future, we will also be vegetarians. And the way that the world runs, and this is very connected with our topic as well, I made a little diagram that it has a lot of ramifications. If Rabbi Kelman will ask me back to give another series, maybe on Rav Kook, maybe we'll learn a lot of the ramifications. But for everybody, the world starts with God. If you believe in God, the world starts with God. But God wears three hats. God is the creator, which he did 5,700 years ago. God wears another hat that he is the Torah giver, which he gave 3,300 years ago. And the third hat which God wears is that he runs history. And that is every day until this day. Now, being that it's all from the same God, all of these points are bringing us to the same goal, which is that the God wants us to return to the godly ideals and the godly morality. That is the point of life. According to Kabbalistic sources, and Rav Kook bases a lot of his writings on this. Now, how does this happen? Just an example of vegetarianism. God, the creator, created man with a conscience that we don't like seeing blood. We feel guilty when we kill animals. And little by little, that is going to get man to be a vegetarian. The God who gave us the Torah gave us a lot of commands. For example, Tsar Balei Chaim, you're not allowed to hurt animals. You're not allowed to slaughter a mother and a child on the same day. You have to shoo away the mother bird before you take the eggs. There are a lot more. And Rav Kook explains that all of these mitzvot are to teach man, even when man was primitive 3,300 years ago, animals have feelings. And you have to be sensitive to their feelings. And even if you're not ready to be a vegetarian, the Torah gives all of these halachot, and rabbis added additional halachot. For example, most of you probably know that you don't make the bracha of Shechianu on leather. Why? Because we would prefer not having to slaughter an animal. So God, Rav Kook calls it, knocks on the heart of mankind so that slowly but surely mankind will become more and more moral. Then the third aspect is God runs history. Now, God, when he gave the Torah 3,300 years ago, he had to allow slavery. Otherwise, the Torah would not have been relevant. Nevertheless, just like God teaches us that kol koneh eved koneh adon le'atzmo, that a person has to treat his slave like his master. If there's one pillow, you give it to the slave. If there's one piece of cake, in my house, we used to give it to my father. Not if you have a slave. A slave gets the one and only piece of cake. Now, Abraham Lincoln, 140 years ago, was living 3,200 years after the Bible was given. And the Bible was telling us for years and generations and centuries, slaves are people. And whenever, as soon as you can, you should free the slaves. And then came Eli Whitney. And the God who runs history helped man discover the cotton gin, which enabled the North to tell the South, listen, now you can free your slaves. You always used to say you can't free your slaves because you have cotton and you have agriculture and there's no agriculture without cheap labor. Well, now there's a cotton gin, and the God of history solved that problem. In other words, it's one and the same God, but he little by little is pushing mankind to advance through our conscience, through the hints in the Torah, for example, that the only hunters in the Torah are Nimrod and Esav, who are not very nice characters. And all of the moral issues to teach us that little by little, if you can do without eating meat, we should. And then today, the God who runs history has helped mankind manufacture protein, which does not have to come from living animals. If so, Rav Kook, and that was a very condensed version of Rav Kook's big book on Chazon HaTzimchonut, Rav Kook is saying that mankind eventually, that is the arrow which the Torah shoots. The Torah shoots an arrow, which is very clear that vegetarianism is the ideal. He himself was not a vegetarian, and I have to admit that I love steak. That's my favorite food. And Rav Kook goes on to say that you should not be a vegetarian until you're really ready for it. But again, if we have time sometime, we can learn. It's Pashut beautiful. And it really gives, it's an eye-opener regarding our whole attitude towards Torah mitzvot. Very, very highly recommended. Continues Rav Kook getting to Korbanot. Animal sacrifices. Let's look together in source 10 bet. 10 And now we are getting to the punchline. And again, what is the major question? How can we harmonize? On the one hand, there is an ideal to be vegetarian. On the other hand, there are so many animal sacrifices that we are not allowed to change the Torah. You know what? Let's start with the Rambam before Rav Kook, just that you should understand where he's coming from. The Rambam writes in Hilchot Mamrim, source 13, Hilchot Mamrim, Perek Bet, halacha aleph. Beitin hagadol, the main beitin, the Sanhedrin. And I also want to point out, parenthetically, before I forget, that the next stage in redemption is the Sanhedrin. The Gemara in Masechet Megillah says that Chazal, from the ninth bracha on in the Shmona Esrei, set up the Shmona Esrei, the Amidah, in the order of redemption, where the ninth bracha is Barech Aleinu, we pray that it should rain in Eretz Yisrael so that the land of Israel should flourish after being deserted for 2,000 years. Then comes the bracha of Tikah b'shofar gadol l'cheruteinu, to bring all the Jews back to the land of Israel. What's the next bracha? Hashiva shofteinu kivarishona. If anybody wants to go down into history and you want to be ahead of your time, Chazal tell us there in Masechet Megillah, Daf Yud Zayin Amud Bet, that the next stage of redemption is to revive the Sanhedrin. And the Sanhedrin has the power of changing anything and everything. The Rambam writes, source number 13. Beit Din HaGadol Shedarshu Ba'achat Min HaMidot, when the Sanhedrin learns out, or a Beit Din, a previous Sanhedrin, learns out from a certain source. Kefi ma shenireh b'neihem shadin kach v'danu din, and they learn out halachot. V'aman achareyam Beit Din acher, v'niralo tam acher listor oto, and a later Beit Din sees to contradict that halacha. Hareza soter v'dan kefi ma shenireh b'neihem. The Rambam is telling us explicitly. I'll give an example. Everybody knows, "Bigarata lebincha," the mitzvah of telling a Haggadah on Leil Pesach to our children. Our children, but it says "bincha." Okay, "bincha" includes also not just your son but also your daughter. On the other hand, on the pasuk v'shinantam livanecha, the Gemara in Masechet Kiddushin brings down that Chazal learned out in the Sifra that the mitzvah is to teach Torah to your sons and not your daughters. The Sanhedrin has no problem whatsoever to change that halacha, and just like banecha includes your daughters regarding the Haggadah, they can say that banecha includes your daughters, also regarding the mitzvah of learning Torah. And I will not be surprised in the least that just like the Chavetz Chaim said 100 years ago that today women need Jewish education and need to learn Torah, I will not be surprised if the Sanhedrin decides to make that drasha. And they don't even have to be greater than the previous Sanhedrin. Pashut, every generation can darshan psukim the way they see fit. Let's jump down to source 15, where the Rambam, again in Hilchot Mamrim, writes as follows. This is min Perek Bet Halacha Dalit. V'yesh lebeitin la'akor et ha'af dvarim elu. The beitin can uproot any kind of gzerot, even if they're not greater than a previous beitin. Lefisha, temporarily. Afal pishu katan min arishonim, even though the Sanhedrin may not be as great as a previous Sanhedrin. Shelo yugzerot elu chamurim medivrei Torah atzma. Sheafilu divrei Torah yesh lechol beitin laakro hora'at sha'a. Every beitin can uproot a Torah, whether not to do something that you're told to do passively, or even to actively uproot and do something that the Torah says not to do. Ketzad, how could this be? Says the Rambam. Beitin shira'u lichazek hadat. When Beitin sees that the best way to strengthen Am Yisrael's connection with Torah will be to put a certain mitzvah or a certain set of mitzvot in the freezer temporarily, or to darshan the psukim differently, and then it doesn't even have to be temporarily. They have the power to do so. And by the way, nobody disagrees with this Rambam. This Rambam is accepted, but it sounds very controversial simply because we haven't had a Sanhedrin for 2,000 years. But Bezrat Hashem, hopefully within our lifetime, and for sure in the lifetime of the younger members here, when we revive the Sanhedrin, then they can make all of these drashot and changes. And it all depends on, will sacrifices bring most Jews closer to Torah, or will it further them from Torah? I have no doubt that as of Tafshin Pei Aleph, as of this year, if you were to take a census among the Jews in the world, animal sacrifices will push more people away than will bring them. And by the way, anybody who has learned the Piskei Halacha of Rav Avadya Yosef knows that this is the secret behind his leniency. Why was Rav Avadya Yosef the most lenient posek of the last 500 years? Because he saw that in a generation where so many Jews are not observing Torah, we have to make the Torah doable and as easy as we can. Rav Kook is saying that also about the Korbanot. Now, how does he apply that? How does he darshan this to the Korbanot? Let us look quickly, because we're running out of time, in Rav Kook, in source, in source number 10 bet. You know what? I'm going to do this orally because we don't have time to do it inside. And you all have the sheets. Whoever can follow inside anyway can do it. Rav Kook says point number one in 10, starting with 10 bet and 10 gimel. Number one, the Torah has no problem to uproot mitzvot, especially by being passive. If the Torah says, in this case, you have to give an animal sacrifice, so just don't give the animal sacrifice. That's a passive uprooting, and that everyone agrees that the Sanhedrin can do. Another point, says Rav Kook, Chazal tell us that kol ha-korbanot betelim v'todai na betela, that in the future, there are not going to be any more sacrifices, animal sacrifices, except for the korban todah. The korban todah is se'ora, is barley. Point number three. Here Rav Kook says, Varval Hashem minchat Yehuda v'Yerushalayim, that same pasuk, which we saw in his commentary on the Sidur, that the Tanakh tells us that it will be pleasing for God, vegetarian sacrifices. Point number four. On the pasuk, korbani lachmi le'ishai, that the sacrifices, animal sacrifices, are described in Parshat Pinchas as bread for my fire. Rav Kook explains, when man will not eat animals anymore, when we will all be vegetarian, that animals will no longer be considered bread. What will be the bread? Vegetarian. And Rav Kook continues, L'reach nichoach, that the sacrifices have to be a pleasant fragrance. I have vegetarians in my family, and I could tell you that they are nauseated by the smell of barbecue. Not all of them, but some of them. Now, if mankind will have matured out of eating meat, then that is not going to be a pleasant fragrance, not to man, and surely not for God. All right, God doesn't need the fragrance anyway, but it's really for us. The whole idea of the sacrifice, that we can feel that we're giving something to God. Point number six, Rav Kook says that all of Sefer Vayikra, listen to this, this is really ingenious. Throughout the Torah, where it talks about sacrifices, animal sacrifices, it's referring to the sons of Aaron. But according to many sources, in the future, the Avodah, the service in the third Beit HaMikdash, will return. Not only will the Kohanim, but also the Bechorim, the firstborn, will do sacrifices. And Rav Kook says, the Sanhedrin can darshan that the whole idea of sacrifices was only when it was just the Kohanim who did it. But when the Bechorim, the firstborns, will return, then that doesn't apply anymore. Now Rav Kook points out that Latid Lavo is a long period. Anybody who's learned rabbinic literature knows that we talk about Yemot HaMashiach. And there is Olam Haba. and there is Tchiyat Amitim, the revival of the dead. There are a lot of futures. And Rav Kook admits, we don't know what future this is talking about. Is it maybe in the 21st century, maybe the Sanhedrin will decide to freeze animal korbanot, maybe then it will return, and then maybe in Tchiyat Amitim it will stop. We don't know the details. But the main point that Rav Kook is making is that if eating animals will be seen, and little by little is seen by more and more people as not ethical or immoral, then so how could God want animal sacrifices? And Rav Kook is preparing this plan to halachically justify it. Now, I just have to do one last line, because in a later letter, in source number 20, Rav Kook writes in a later letter, this is in Tafresh Pei, he wrote Chazon HaTzimchonut and all this in his earlier career. In 1920, when he's already chief rabbi, he writes as follows to Rav Chaim Hirshenson, who was around in Hoboken, New Jersey. U'b'inyan ha-korbanot gam ken yoter nachon la'amin she'akol yashuv al mechono. Rav Kook says, sorry, I didn't scroll down. In all probability, there will be animal sacrifices and they will return just like everything else. There are some who say that when Rav Kook was chief rabbi, he couldn't be so controversial. He had to also speak and cater also to the more conservative, with a small c, the more Haredim element. We all know that that's conjecture. You can't know. We can't know. Nobody, it's an educated guess. One thing is for sure, maybe. Maybe there will be animal sacrifices. Maybe there won't be animal sacrifices. But what we've seen today is the importance of reviving the Sanhedrin, not just regarding this question, but regarding just about every question that all of us have on Judaism. The answer is Judaism is not outdated. What we have to do is revive the Sanhedrin. Anybody wants to know how? There are two Sfarim of how to do it. And we are out of time. So if anybody has questions or comments, I will be happy to answer. I have to go into chat. I learned how to do this. Go up to the top. Okay.
Thank you. By the way, Rabbi, what's the second sefer? I have the one here by Yehuda Leib Maimon on the revival of the Sanhedrin. What's the second one?
Now I remember that we spoke about this once.
Right, there we spoke about it.
Another of Maimon, who also lived in Jerusalem, also in the 1950s, wrote another sefer, almost exactly with the same name, Chidush HaSanhedrin, according to the Reviving the Sanhedrin, according to the Rambam. And they were both named Rabbi Maimon. They both probably did not know about each other's writings. It's like many of you may know Professor Katan wrote a very scholarly, important work translating all of Rashi's old French into modern Hebrew and English. And he did not know at the same time that there was a rabbi in England who dedicated his life to doing the same thing. And there was a third rabbi, I think, in Belgium at the same time who was doing the same thing. And it's an idea whose time had come. Just like in the time of the Beit Yosef, the Lavush and the Ramah and the Beit Yosef, they all did the same thing because it's an idea whose time had come. So I forgot his first name, but his last name is Maimon.
Okay. Anyways, you want me to feed you the questions? You want to take questions on your own?
I can see them.
Yeah, okay.
Very much in the Talmudic tradition, new. I don't understand the question. Was Rav Kook in the Talmudic tradition? Yes, the answer is yes. Anybody who's read any of his books, the answer is very clearly yes. Unless somebody wants to clarify that question, you can clarify it afterwards. Here are the sources. Toda, my pleasure. Jerba is Tunisia, right? North Africa. And there are now, what did I say, Morocco? Okay. Yeah. There are now genetic markers for Kohanim. Yes. What percentage of male Kohanim can trace back to Aaron? Not many, or even five generations. Many can, as stated, a few dozen or a hundred or two. It's a lot more than two. Definitely hundreds. especially when each family today has hundreds of members. There are Rappaport Kohanim. I'm sure there are hundreds of male Kohanim. And as I mentioned, among the Yemenites, I know there is a Maguri family. I have a friend named Maguri who they have their father to father to father lineage. Definitely thousands, maybe even tens of thousands. I don't know. But again, from Jerba and from Yemen, those are the most common families. You can listen to Dr. Carl Skoretsky, a Toronto native, talk on the Cohen gene and other related issues. Yafeh. I actually remember that it was a joint genetic project between a geneticist in Israel, a geneticist in North America, I guess that is this Dr. Skoretsky, and also one in Europe. Maybe it was England, I don't remember, but there were three, and they did a lot of testing on male Kohanim all over the world.
If I can interject for a second, Carl Skoretsky, anybody who knows in Toronto knows he was beyond a super genius. He got the gold medal at University of Toronto Medical School and whatever. And then he made Aliyah 25 years ago. And he taught at Harvard, he taught at U of T. And then he made Aliyah on the first Shabbos, or when he's in Shul in Haifa. He's at the Technion, or he was at the Technion. And there's a Yemenite gets the first Aliyah. And he's sitting there and he says, he's a Kohen. He's a Kohen. He says, you know, I'm a Kohen. And he's a Kohen. We look very, very different, you know, our backgrounds. And he started doing research. And he was when he published then in Nature magazine, his research. I don't know what the official name is. There's a scientific name for the Cohen gene. And then he's done a lot of work on that more. And somebody wrote to me that he now has gone much beyond that, which I did not know, now has a Jewish gene. And whatever that he's working on. I know he's working with the Rabbanut and Paskening and Russians, all kinds of, all kinds of things you can use this for halachically. But anyways, just to fill in some of the details.
Very interesting. That's another example, in my opinion, that there will be a need. Usually necessity is the mother of invention. And whether it be the issue of the Olim from Russia who have non-Jewish mothers, or whether it be, there's going to come some issue which is going to force us to revive the Sanhedrin. And that idea of Agunot and the idea of Mamzerim, and this can really help out. By the way, the problem is that it could also make a lot of Mamzerim. And that's why a lot of poskim say, let's keep the 99.9% status of the DNA checks. And that will save many possible mamzerim. Yes, the Kohen Gadol wears shatnez. Again, that's another question on Professor Leibovich. If vegetarianism is the ideal, then why did not God make all the animals herbivorous? That Rav Kook also, just in the little that we learned in Chazon HaTzimchonut, Rav Kook deals with that. And he says that, yes, in the future, Begar Ze'evim Kevitz, it's a machlokin, it's a difference of opinion between Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Yehuda, whether it's meant to be taken literally. And Rav Kook says, if it's meant to be taken literally, maybe we will tame the lion to live with the lamb. I have neighbors, by the way, who have a dog and a cat, and they get along fine. So maybe, if it's meant to be taken literally. Didn't Jacob send Esav to hunt an animal for him in Pshat? Yes, that was after we left the Garden of Eden, and after the second fall in the Mabul, in the flood. After the flood, everyone agrees that you're allowed to eat meat. And Yitzchak was 11 generations after the flood. Easy to be vegan as well now. Okay. I should point out something. I mentioned this somewhere. I give a class in Petach Tikva. And the Nazir, Rav Kook's, one of his three prime students, was a vegetarian. He did not wear leather shoes. He did not drink wine. He did not eat meat. He also, by the way, he knew 9 languages, but once he came on Aliyah, he would only speak Lashon HaKodesh, Hebrew. And I was giving this class in Petach Tikva. The average age is about 70. So I asked, there are about 200, 250 women, Did anybody here remember the Nazir? Know the Nazir? He passed away, if I remember correctly, in the 70s. So there are three women who grew up in Yerushalayim, and they remembered him. And I asked them, as an archivist, if they could please approach me. I learned from experience, you always have to learn people's knowledge before it's too late. We don't live forever. And I asked them what they remember about the Nazir. And one of the women who grew up on a Moshav Beit Meir, a little west of Yerushalayim, some of you may know, or Yerushalayim. And she said her father had a lul. Her father had chicken coops. And she, as a little girl, would go with her father once a week to bring chicken eggs to the Nazir out of respect. Now, just a week beforehand, I had a student in one of my midrashot who asked me, was the Nazir a vegan or a vegetarian? And I said, I didn't know. Now I had the answer. The Nazir was a vegetarian. He did eat eggs. Today, that it is doable to be a vegan, there's a good chance that he would be a vegan, but your guess is as good as mine. Choosing a Sanhedrin with real power might be trickier feat than peace with some Arab or Muslim regimes. Remember, both Perushim, early rabbis, and Sadukim were on some of the previous ones. Okay, nobody's saying that it will be easy, but in my humble opinion, I think having a Jewish state and in gathering 7 million Jews from 102 different countries is a lot more difficult and a lot more miraculous than just setting up a Sanhedrin. And anybody who learns that Sefer that Rabbi Kelman was holding before will see that it really is not that complicated. There have been rabbis who are accepted by all the chugim. That's like, is the biggest trick. You know, who's accepted if he's a chassid, the misnagdim won't want him, and vice versa. And if he's an Ashkenazic, the Sephardim won't want him, and vice versa. And if he's a Zionist, the anti-Zionist won't want him, and vice versa. And I answer that Rav Moshe Feinstein was accepted by everyone. And Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach was accepted by everyone. And today, again, I want to sign off, but if anybody wants to look up the name Rav Usher Weiss, Rav Usher Weiss, he is accepted. He's a Tzanzer Chassid, so the Chassidim like him. He's also Rosh Yeshiva in a Lithuanian yeshiva. He also gives Shiurim in Zionist yeshivot and also an anti-Zionist yeshivot. He is modern. His mother tongue is English. He came on Aliyah at a young age. So he can talk with presidents and kings and take down the name. And if anybody wants to go down in history and have a name, a street named after you in Yerushalayim or throughout Israel, you could take the ball and run with it. Somebody is going to do it. So it may as well be you or you or you or you.
So there you really are an optimist.
How do you understand all of our tefillot that contemplate restoration of animal sacrifice, such as all the tefillot Musaf and Ritzei in the regular Midah? Again, to change a wording here or wording there, the Sanhedrin is mamash, no problem. What we have to do is we have to change the mindset and get into and revive the Sanhedrin. But you just learn just those two halachot, which I learned for with you from the Rambam and Ilchot Mamrim. You see, it's mamash, not a problem at all. And Judaism will return to being a living Torah and an updated Torah a lot sooner than people realize. And if people think logically, I think that that will bring a lot of people closer to Torah by updating it. And only a Sanhedrin can make these type of changes. How do you understand all of our that we answered? I think it was Northern African Cohen. Who was a Northern African Cohen? Oh, who this professor
I said from Yemen. I'll go. Okay. That's okay. Where south. Yeah, I don't know.
He probably looked different anyway. But can you disenfranchise those whose ritual practice you do not approve of, especially if they are the majority? Yes, a Sanhedrin can and will do that. And Rav Kook actually deals with that. And he says that the beauty of the Sanhedrin is that if you take the 70 greatest geniuses of the Jewish people and put them on one body, and yes, they will argue it out, but in the end, it's brought to a vote. And everybody has to accept the majority rule. Even if you think you're wrong, now you have to listen to the Sanhedrin. Rav Kook goes on to say that when the secular people today, I think today with the help of Zoom and Torah in Motion and similar websites, will be able to hear the greatness of a Rav Moshe Feinstein, of a Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, of a Rav Asher Weiss, and to see firsthand their greatness and their knowledge, then also the secular, and also Rav Kook says, even the Charedim will not say they are holier than thou. They cannot say they are holier than the Sanhedrin. And another advantage of the Sanhedrin is that when you have collective responsibility, nobody has to look over their shoulder to worry about what they're going to say or what they're going to say. In other words, the Sanhedrin, the Judaism that we have today without a Sanhedrin is really abnormal. And we have to return to the original. That's what Rav Kook is saying. So you closest ideal is Iran? I didn't catch that. But can you disenfranchise those who ritual practice you do not approve of, especially if they are the majority? So the answer is, yes, the Sanhedrin will represent the majority. And whatever they decide obligates all of us. So you closest ideal is Iran. I understand the question. The question is, that does not sound democratic. And again, the idea is that little by little, when people will learn more and more Torah, the hope is that the truth of the Torah will convince more and more people. And the Sanhedrin is not interested and will not be interested in forcing themselves on the people. There will not be malkot, lashes in the Sanhedrin. They will not have chiyuv mitah, just like they really didn't put anyone to death, even when there was a Sanhedrin. There are a lot of things that the Sanhedrin could do, but doesn't do. And the bottom line is, like the Rambam says, anything to bring people closer to Judaism. And like I said, I just hope that it will be in our generation and not just in my children's generation.
Thank you. As you know, of course, the Sanhedrin is not allowed to issue a ruling that the majority of the people cannot stand. And I forget the Hebrew expression, Robert Sieber Einam Yecholim Lamad Bo, that one of the rules is that a rabbinic decree does not get off the ground unless the majority of people accept it. Obviously, we're living, you know, in a society when people are not religious. That's a whole different equation, but that's way beyond what we're are talking about now. But there are many, many democratic forces within the Senate. It's all of Jewish law. Acharei Rabbim Lahatot, that's the whole notion. We follow majority. It's a very, you know, and all the democratic ideals of freedom, et cetera, et cetera. We all have them in our
Torah. Yeah, and you read Hebrew. I wrote an article, and you can find it in Hebrew, just Google Ari Shvat, about the checks and balance system between the Sanhedrin and the government and the prophecy in Urim Vetumim.
Right. I mean, what I always like to call the separation of church and state in Judaism is not exactly like the American model, but then obviously we want our state to follow the Torah, but the Kohanim and the Melucha have to be totally separate. And because when religion and politics mixes in the way it does, it's often, that's real shatnes. What can I say? But that's another discussion.
Rabbi Kalman said, nobody has to worry because the Sanhedrin will always be in contact with the people and they won't do anything the people don't want.
Okay. Anyways, it is late. I know we went late with the questions, and I know people. Okay, I hope that's all right. I mean, we're always willing to stay to answer questions as you know, long as we can. And this evening, Mark Shapiro, class 48, in his almost ended series on his correspondence with great rabbinic figures. I invite everybody to attend if you have not yet come. That's at 8:30 this evening. And then tomorrow, actually, we don't have any classes. Next Tuesday, we'll be starting a new series, a few new series. We'll keep you posted. Then Wednesday, Marty Lukshin, the Haftorah, et cetera, and, you know, Parsha, and on Thursday, Pirkei Avot on Friday. And everybody be well and have a wonderful day. It's a holiday in Canada. Those in the States may not know. It's Victoria Day here, Queen Victoria. We are still part of the monarchy. Queen Elizabeth is our official head of state, and today is Victoria Day. And anyways, for I might as well say that next Monday is Memorial Day for those who live in America. And anyway, so we should have many occasions to celebrate, although Memorial Day is not really meant as a celebratory holiday, but only in Israel is Memorial Day a real type of a Memorial Day. In America, it's become a long weekend anyways. But all right, that's another discussion, and everybody should be well, and we should have good things to remember and to celebrate all together. Okay, have a wonderful day, everybody. Bye-bye.
Shalom.
And next week, Rabbi, next week's that we conclude class seven. That's a seven-part series, you know, like seven, the magic number
right.
in Judaism, this series. So invite your friends and we'll see you next week. Okay, thank you.